You're listening to UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell, and this is The Smartest Doctor in the Room, where real medicine meets real answers. Each episode, I bring you honest conversations with some of the brightest minds in health and medicine. Let's get started. Toxic mold exposure in the home is dangerous to your health. I see patients every week in my practice who are suffering from the effects of toxic mold. And in many cases, they were living in a home where they didn't even know mold was present. That's why I recommend to patients who suspect they are ill, possibly from toxic mold exposure, to obtain a test from Immunolytics, a company that specializes in mold detection with simple mold plates for your home or office. The mold plates are put in various rooms of your home and then left open for an hour. They are then closed up and you observe them for 5 days. If the mold plates show growth, you can send them back to Immunolytics and the company will analyze them and interpret the results for you. Please see the link in the show notes to order your mold plates from Immunolytics and use the code SMARTESTDOC to get a 5% discount. Today's podcast, we're going to be discussing why Parkinson's disease is exploding and really what can be done to prevent it. Now, Parkinson's disease is a neurological disorder that I am sure almost all of us know somebody that suffers from it. You know, personally for me, I remember when I was in high school, way before I became a doctor, my grandfather developed Parkinson's disease. It was difficult to see a person who was really personally my hero struggle to walk, to stay still without tremors. And he had lost that facial expression, which I came to identify him with. My guest today, Dr. Ray Darcy, is an expert in Parkinson's disease. He's formerly the David M. Levy Professor of Neurology at University of Rochester, which I think he's still affiliated with. He's now the director of the Center for Brain and Environment at the Atria Health and Research Institute, I believe in New York City, where the mission is finding the root of a lot of neurological conditions like autism and Alzheimer's. And he's also the author of two really, I'm telling you, wonderful books. The newer one is The Parkinson's Plan, and a little bit older, which was terrific also, was Ending Parkinson's Disease. So with that, I'd love to introduce Dr. Ray Darcy to our listeners.
Dean, delighted to be with you. Thank you very much for having me as your guest.
Okay. You know, Dr. Darcy, I always love going a little bit into people's background. And, you know, I think one of the fascinating things about medicine, since it's such a wide area, like why someone chooses a certain area. So why did you choose neurology? And I'm just going to preface it with neurology is a fascinating area of medicine. But as we all know, when we went into it, and although things are changing, there wasn't a lot of treatment. It was kind of like the really smart guys went into it, but it was more like, it sounded like they were just curious to diagnose these difficult diseases. So why did you pick neurology of all the different specialties?
Sure, and Dr. Mitchell, let's hear me call you Dr. Mitchell. You're going to need to call me Ray.
Anything you want. Call me Dean, Dr. Dean, my patients call me, whatever. You call me Dean.
Perfect, call me Ray. I have two wonderful parents. They're both psychiatrists, so I rebelled and became a neurologist.
I see. You're getting back at them. Okay. All right. Is that the simple answer?
That's the simple answer.
Let's do this when we first start out. So we're going to get into a lot of things about your book, things I really enjoyed in helping the listeners. Can you define Parkinson's disease and I guess what they call syndrome or signs of Parkinson's, just so, you know, because a lot of people think they know what it is, but, and I know also, we'll get into this, a lot of times the diagnosis is not so super clear.
Yeah, so at a high level, there's a term called Parkinsonism, which just means you have the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, and classically there are four major symptoms. Tremor, shakiness, usually in one hand, usually asymmetric, at rest. Second is slowness of movement, nearly universal. Third is stiffness, and fourth is difficulty with gait or balance. If you have two of those following four symptoms, you have Parkinsonism. The most common cause of Parkinsonism, about 60-70%, is Parkinson's disease. There are some other causes like medications, antipsychotic medications, for example, can cause Parkinsonism. There are some worse disorder, other Parkinsonian disorders, progressive supranuclear palsy, dementia with Lewy bodies, and others. But that's the classic ones. And the disease, I'll just stop there.
Okay. No, that's helpful because, People, I'm going to get into this. One of the things in your first book, which was really interesting, a lot of times you see people on the street, and and also, sometimes I go to communities where I see elderly people, and I see a lot of them walking slow and with a cane, and you're always wondering, do they have Parkinson's? Are they just being extra careful? Is this just, the result of old age?
Parkinson's disease is not a natural consequence of
Yeah, so
aging.
we're going to
It
get
is
into
an
that. Yeah.
unnatural consequence of aging. People should look like your wife's grandfather. That's what they should be looking like. Look, John Adams is age 90 in 1826, writing letters to Thomas Jefferson, age 83. He's sharp. He's clear,
Wow.
right? He didn't
Yeah.
have Parkinson's disease. Thomas Jefferson didn't have dementia. Parkinson's disease is not a natural consequence of aging. You put a mouse in the lab and you let it age, it will never, never spontaneously develop Parkinson's disease. The only way it'll develop Parkinson's disease is if I manipulate its genes or expose it to toxic chemicals. And the same could be said of Alzheimer's disease.
That's a great and important thing, I think, for everybody to listen to, because I think it is like frightening, that sometimes, again, I looked at my grandfather and I see other people and I'm like, is this what I have to look forward to?
Let's just talk about Dr. Parkinson. So Dr. Parkinson's 61. He's a physician, and he observes people on the streets of London with a disease that he said has not been classified in the medical literature. So you might be close to 61. He basically writes a 50-page case series on six individuals. 50 pages.
Wow, I didn't know that. Wow.
So this had to be something that was like disturbing to him, right? It can't be just like, oh, it's just a little bit of this. He said this has not been classified in medical literature. He goes to great lengths to say that tremor has been described for many years, centuries even. Shakespeare describes tremor in some of his characters. But this stoop posture that you were talking about in your grandfather, this shuffling gait, this propensity to fall forward, along with the tremor, he said this is a disease that's not been classified in the medical literature. He thinks he's describing something new or something at a minimum that was extraordinarily rare. He described six people in 1817 with this disease. 200 years later, it's estimated that 6 million people worldwide have the disease. So, how do you go from a disease that's not classified in the medical literature affecting six people on the streets of London to one affecting 6 million people worldwide and being the world's fastest growing brain disease? It can't be genetics, right? Our genes don't change enough in that period of time. Aging alone doesn't explain it. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson are alive in 1817. They don't have Parkinson's disease. Ben Franklin's probably died a little bit before then, don't have Parkinson's disease. Martha Washington's alive, doesn't have Parkinson's disease. So the only thing that changes in that period of time is our environment. So the principal causes of Parkinson's disease do not lie within us. They are not in our DNA. They are not in our genes. They lie outside of us in our environment, in chemicals, in our food, water, and air.
What was it about London in that time that maybe this appeared there versus
Yeah.
in the farmlands of, I don't know, I'm gonna say like, I don't know, like Austria or something.
Yeah.
What was so significant about London?
So what's going on in London? It's the height of the Industrial Revolution, and London's the capital. The air quality in 1800 London is equivalent to when the skies over the Big Apple in New York City, where I'm sitting right now, turned orange. So remember those Canadian wildfires and
Right,
they turned to
right.
the skies? That was the same level of air pollution as 1800 London. Same level of air pollution as India today, same level of air pollution at Beijing at its worst level. You couldn't even see across the street the air pollution it was so bad. And so I think Dr. Parkinson is describing the chronic effects of high levels of air pollution in 1800 London. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he's describing it in London. I don't think it's a coincidence he's describing it in 1817 when the air pollution in London is reaching its worst levels.
Yeah, Ray, I know in my practice too, which is, I think it's fascinating, so many of my patients, because I do like functional medicine along with my immunology, and so many of them are so concerned about their diet, which they should
Yeah.
be. But I
Yeah.
always tell them, I'm really concerned about the air quality you're breathing. I think it's just something in medicine that we've taken for granted. I'm not
So
sure why, but
let's take
it's.
a so every physician measures systolic blood pressure, right? And systolic hypertension is a major source of disability worldwide. Do you know what's more disabling than systolic hypertension? Air pollution. Air pollution costs humans across the world on average 3 years of life. But for air pollution, all of us would be living 3 years longer of life. If you want to live a short, unhealthy life, breathe polluted air. And it's not Parkinson's disease, you know, asthma, you know, I'm speaking to an allergy immunologist, you know, respiratory disease, coronary artery disease, stroke. The list is huge. Alzheimer's disease, oh my goodness, is doing it. And I think for air pollution, what is air pollution? So air pollution, when you see smog in LA, you're seeing little pieces of dirt and soot suspended in the air. Scientists give the fancy term particulate matter. And hitchhiking on those pieces of particulate matter are toxic metals, lead from gasoline, iron from brakes, platinum from catalytic converters. Most of them we cough out or sneeze out, but some are so small, 1/30th the width of our hair, I'm losing my hair, and they're small enough to penetrate the nerve hanging down in our nose responsible for smell, the olfactory nerve. And they take these metals back to the smell center. And where do you see the pathology of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's first? You see it in the smell center or the olfactory bulb. What's one of the earliest features of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's? Loss of smell.
That's very important. I think that's very underappreciated because, again, people don't notice it. You're 100% right. And also, I believe, again, in my area, too, like an autoimmunity, too, at times. It could be like what we call a prodrome, like 10 to 15 years before something manifests. There's a doctor that I've worked with. She used to like to say that the nose is the elevator to the brain.
Hi, everyone. I know you may already know from listening to my podcast that I specialize in treating patients with toxic mold exposure. It's become a serious problem for many years as we deal with the hurricanes and floods throughout the country. You know, even simple bathroom water leaks from a toilet in your home over time can contribute to mold buildup. I can help patients that suffer from the symptoms of toxic mold, but I also rely on the patients getting their current residence inspected so they are not continually being exposed. My go-to person for mold exposure is Joe Reese. Joe is a certified mold inspector with decades of experience. He is super thorough and gives you a straightforward assessment and tells you whether it's safe to live in your home or if there is mold. I should know, I used Joe when I moved to my new home 4 years ago. Fortunately, when I moved in, I smelled an unusual odor in my basement, and I immediately called Joe. He came over with his instruments, and he found the problem. Afterwards, I had remediation, and the problem was solved. Joe does inspections all throughout the country. He welcomes calls to his cell phone at 908-451-4592. You can also reach him by email at jprconsultants7929@gmail.com. Remember, mold in your home is not a good thing, but thankfully it's a problem that can be fixed.
Yeah, I would just say it's the front door of the brain.
Yeah.
And it's not protected. It's not protected by the blood-brain barrier, right? So
right.
This is going right through a nerve that's hanging up in our upper nasal passages and going back. And it takes 15 to 20 years because it needs to spread, in the case of Alzheimer's disease, from our smell center to something called the hippocampus. In Alzheimer's, in Parkinson's, it needs to spread to a relay station called the amygdala, which connects to the substantia nigra, which we know is damaged in Parkinson's disease. By the time someone gets Parkinson's disease, 60% of the nerve cells in the substantia nigra have died off. That didn't happen overnight, didn't happen over a day, a week, a month, or even a year. It takes years or decades to do this. So the seeds of Parkinson's disease, the seeds of Alzheimer's disease are planted early. What longevity has allowed us to do is for sufficient time to pass, for the disease to unfold, for the symptoms to become manifest. And longevity has allowed us to see the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Just like longevity is a prerequisite to seeing lung cancer. If you smoke in your 20s and you die in a car accident at 40, you're not getting lung cancer.
Right.
If you live into your 50s or 60s or 70s, the incidence of lung cancer increases. The same is true with Parkinson's disease, I think. The seeds are planted early, sometimes as a teenager in your 20s, sometimes in childhood, perhaps even in utero. And what longevity allows to do is allows time for the disease to progress, for the symptoms to manifest, and for the diagnosis to be made.
Yeah, I think that what you're saying is such an important point for our listeners. I mean, I know, because even when you're young, I think you really have to be a little bit careful and protective. I can't remember. It might have been in the article that I saw that you were quoted. It was in the New York Times. It was interesting. They were talking about a brother and a sister who both developed Parkinson's. I think it was in their 70s. But it turns out, I think they worked in the family's dry cleaning store for years.
Yeah.
And then it manifested later on. And just to go to your other thing, too, is like, you know, that whole concept of the blue zones, the areas, those seven areas around the world where people live the longest and the healthiest.
You know, people are always thinking about, oh, what's their diet? What are they drinking? It's probably they have the cleanest air.
Yeah.
You know, that's
maybe. Yeah. So when I watched the Blue Zones, what did I see? I saw clean food, I saw clean water, and I saw clean air. And I saw only one person with possibly Parkinson's. I mean, on all those episodes, only one with possibly Parkinson's. If you don't, if you have clean air, if you have clean food, if you have clean water, you have a world where Parkinson's largely does not exist.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Do we have any idea why these environmental things are causing the destruction of dopamine? And it's obviously such an essential neurotransmitter for functioning in the brain.
Yeah, so Parkinson's damages neurons in the brain, but it doesn't damage all parts of the brain, right? It doesn't damage the part of the brain responsible for visual processing.
Right. But like a lot of Parkinson's patients would have very good memory, let's just say, or cognitive impairment, possibly.
Speech, language, all these things are relatively intact, especially early in the course.
Right.
So there is selective vulnerability of neurons to these chemicals. These chemicals all damage the mitochondria, which is the energy producing parts of cells. Your brain's only 2% of your body weight, but 20% of your energy consumption. The dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra are huge. If you spread them out, they're 4 meters in length, twice my height. They have 1 million different dendritic connections, and they're not insulated. They're not myelinated. In short, they have huge energy demands. One of my colleagues said, Ray, imagine them as a huge garbage bag. They're filled with jelly beans, and those jelly beans are mitochondria. And so if you expose these neurons to mitochondrial toxicants or things that damage the energy-producing parts of cells, these are the cells that are going to be most vulnerable and most likely to be harmed by these chemicals.
And the location in the brain is the reason it doesn't affect the cognitive, because that area, like as you mentioned, just so for our listeners to know, there's something called the substantia nigra, which is very interesting, because when I did anatomy, as Dr. Dorsey did, and you actually do the neuroanatomy, and you see, like, it looks like a little ink spot in the brain where the substantia nigra stands for black.
Yeah.
So, but the fact where that location is that the reason it most likely is affecting motor, function, and not your cognitive?
Yeah. So location's important, and and its huge energy demands. So in 2003, so Dr. Parkinson, when he described the condition, he naturally thought it was due to a brain disease. He thought it was part of the lower brainstem called the medulla that was impacted. In 2003, this really smart German pathologist, Heiko Brock, who's still living, he says that Parkinson's disease does not begin in the brain. He says the first places I see the pathology of Parkinson's disease is I see it in the smell center, as we talked about before, Or I see it in the nerve that goes to the gut, something called the vagus.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I wanted to ask you, it was shocking. I was reading an article in Scientific American. I think it's when I interviewed these researchers on Parkinson's they were originally at Penn. And I think the German group was saying 50% of the Parkinson cases, they believe, starts in the gut. And it gets to the brain via the vagus nerve, which I've interviewed some top experts on vagus nerve and how it affects, obviously, this mind-brain connection. Tell me, so how do you think that's working? Do you think something in the microbiome is affecting the gut and it's slowly tracking up to the brain?
If you've been following the podcast, you may know I practice holistic functional medicine and immunology. In fact, at Mitchell Medical Group, we've been treating chronic fatigue patients for 3 decades. It's critical in this work to have a trusted pharmacy that can compound medications for our sensitive patients' needs. ITC Pharmacy has been our go-to pharmacy the entire time. They can make medications ranging from thyroid hormones to dye-free medications for all of our highly sensitive, even allergic patients. If you or your holistic doctor are looking for these very specific patient medications, you can contact ITC at 888-349-5453. They have licenses throughout the country and can have medications delivered right to your doorsteps. My patients have been so pleased with their service, and you will be too.
In 2019, a colleague said there's two forms of Parkinson's, one that begins in the nose, he calls that brain first, and one that begins in the gut, he calls it that body first. Let's talk about gut.
Yeah.
So I emailed him and I said, hey, how does this model fit in with toxin, chemicals that we ingest or swallow? So if you drink well water, which is often contaminated, often in rural areas, often near farms, contaminated by pesticides, not regulated by the Safe Drinking Water Act, you consume pesticides. These pesticides could lead to misfolding of a protein, something called alpha-synuclein, that starts in the gut and then spreads up the vagus nerve. So as you know, the vagus nerve goes from our gut all the way up to the lower part of our brain. And once it gets to the lower part of the brain, it then spreads, the misfolded protein spreads from nerve cell to nerve cell. So it goes from the lower part, something called the medulla, to the part of the brain that's responsible for sleep. So you get early sleep disturbances, REM sleep behavior disorder, and it spreads from that part to the substantia nigra, where you get the motor features of the disease. So it's basically the third stage of Parkinson's. When you look at the pathology, is it starts in the nerve that goes to the gut, then to the nerve that's responsible for regulating sleep. So you get early sleep disturbances, and then it gets to the part of the brain that's responsible for movement. If you start in the nose, it goes from the nose, and then it just makes one stop, just like going from New York to Seattle. You might stop in Seattle. It stops at the amygdala, and then from the amygdala, it goes back to substantia nigra. So it's just one stop and you can get back to the substantia nigra, which produces the symptoms, which produces the external symptoms that doctors can diagnose. If doctors were sitting around with sniffing sticks, they would, or measures of constipation, they would probably be able to identify the disease earlier.
You know, just so I'm clear too, this is a little bit technical for the listeners, but I find it fascinating. So you mentioned about the alpha-synuclein, which you said it's in the GI tract, right?
It's almost in every nerve cell. And so the gut obviously has nerves in it. It's called the enteric plexus because, you know, the gut is moving. And in order for muscles to move, they need to get signals from nerve cells. And so in the gut are nerve cells, and some of those nerve cells project all the way up through the vagus nerve, which, you know, is responsible for slowing down and allowing digestion. When our activity slows down, it allows digestion to occur.
Do we know anything why one versus the other gets set on?
These are all called protein misfolding disorders, which, you know, we didn't learn about in medical school. Or maybe there was a little bit. And the really neat thing, at least from a scientific perspective, is that this misfolded protein can spread from nerve cell to nerve cell. As the misfolded protein spreads from nerve cell, it leads to destruction. As it leads to destruction, it leads to new symptoms. So if it starts in the vagus nerve, which is responsible for digestion, you destroy it, you get constipation. If you destroy the nerve cells in the part of the brain that are responsible for sleep, you get sleep disturbances, you act out your dreams. If it spreads up to the part of the brain that controls movement, you get slowness of movement and tremor. Now, both Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease are due to a misfolded protein. The type of misfolded protein is called alpha-synuclein, and Alzheimer's is called beta-amyloid. It appears that air pollution might lead to triggering of misfolding of alpha-synuclein and or beta-amyloid. Now, why does the same chemical or same toxin lead to misfolding of alpha-synuclein in some people and Parkinson's in some people and Alzheimer's in some and nothing in others and both in a few? That I don't know. It's kind of like, I like the analogy I like to say is like, why does smoking lead to lung cancer in some individuals, about 10%? Why does it lead to emphysema in others? Why does it lead to heart disease?
Yeah, I think there's some genetic, you know, obviously. It could be genetic,
it could be chance, it could be dose, it could be duration, it could be route of exposure, it could be when the exposure happened. But all of these brain diseases, which everyone fears, a lot of them are due to misfolding of proteins that I think are triggered by exposure to environmental toxicants. And as the misfolded protein spreads throughout the brain, you get different symptoms corresponding with the parts of it, with the areas of the brain that are affected.
You know, the thing that people sometimes could possibly get alarmed about, you know, chronic constipation is a fairly common condition. Acting out in your dreams. When would somebody start to get concerned about these things? You know, is it ever like a little bit of a tipping point where they're like, okay, this is not your everyday constipation. This is not your everyday having some bad nightmares.
So the acting out the dreams, the REM sleep behavior disorder. So normally when we dream, which is during REM sleep, when our eye movements are moving, rapid eye movement, we're normally paralyzed. So if we're getting chased by a tiger, we're getting chased by a tiger, but we're not running in bed. In Parkinson's disease, early Parkinson's disease, that in some individuals, that loss of paralysis is lost. So you act out your dreams. About 80% of people who have REM sleep behavior disorder go on to develop some kind of neurodegenerative condition. So if you have REM sleep behavior disorder, it's definitely worth, if you're acting out your dreams, striking your bed partner, screaming in the middle of the night, is probably worth seeing a doctor about that. Now, constipation, as you know, all of us, I think almost all of us experience constipation at some point in time, and most of us won't develop Parkinson's disease. So I think there is a little bit less, sense is a little bit less concerning. You know, the easy things is, you know, fluids and increased fiber intake addresses a lot of constipation. So that in of itself will give me a little bit less concern. It turns out that people, aside from COVID, people who lose their sense of smell, that's a concerning risk factor for both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So I think in the future, we'll be doing more screening of smell, a loss of smell, to see if people are at higher risk for developing these conditions.
I guess something organic, isn't it like perfect? So again, why the vegetables and everything, even like the organic stuff? Suppose it's not pesticides. Why do we have to worry about it?
Yeah, so I'll give you number one is wash your produce, even your organic ones. Pesticides have contaminated our food supply. Remnants of the pesticides are found in 20% of common foods. Organic produce, dairy products, and meat have lower levels, so they can reduce your exposure. So if you can afford organic, buy organic.
Okay, let's talk about diet, because we were talking about the gut before. And, you know, look, I've done the podcast for 5 years. I've been practicing for 30 years. You know, diet is still a mystery to all of us. You know, again, we tend to think the Mediterranean diet tends to be healthy, but maybe you get to, they have such good air in a lot of these places, it doesn't matter. But why do you think the Mediterranean diet, or what dietary things should people be careful if they want to try to avoid Parkinson's?
So the evidence suggests that a Mediterranean diet, high in fruits and vegetables, low in animal products, can reduce your risk of Parkinson's and may slow your progression. Now, why is that? I take a little bit different thing. I get most concerned about pesticides getting in our food supply. And so when you're eating a cow, you're not just eating a cow, you're eating what the cow ate. And so if the cow is eating grass or other grass that's sprayed with pesticides, especially fat-loving pesticides, what's that cow going to do with those pesticides? It puts it into its milk. And then there's been a study that showed that in Hawaii, high consumers of milk had higher rates of Parkinson's disease.
Oh, my gosh.
And then those who had higher consumption of milk had fewer, when they looked at their brains, they had fewer dopamine-producing nerve cells. And when they looked in their brains, they found the residue of a pesticide that had been spread on the chop, on the feed that the cows had eaten. So I get really concerned about eating animal products, and I like dairy, so I like cheese. I get concerned about what's being concentrated in that dairy product as it makes its way up the food chain. And I get really concerned about these fat-loving pesticides because they are more likely, I think, to be absorbed through the gut and can be more damaging in people with Parkinson's.
You know, it's very scary though too. I'm not a big fish lover, but I do get alarmed too when people eat a lot of fish, and it's kind of sad because we think about all the supposedly the health benefits, even of salmon or whatever, but it seems like also the waters are very polluted. Is that just as...
Yeah, so there was a study looking at the Inuit in Greenland, and it found out that the Inuit in Greenland who ate lots of whale blubber had higher rates of Parkinson's disease than people in the other regions of the North Atlantic. And it turned out that in the whale blubber is a class of chemicals called PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, that were widely used in the electronics industry, fat-soluble, damage the mitochondria. So they were eating magnified concentrations of these of this toxicant in the whale blubber that the whale had concentrated in their fat. So I just get really, really, really concerned that as you eat, go up the food chain, you're eating what the animals have eaten. And as the animals eat fat-soluble toxicants, they concentrate them in higher levels, 100-fold sometimes, higher than you would normally get if you just ate it without it going through the animal and as the animal.
All right, let's talk about beverages, the good old water. Now, you mentioned here too, check your well, get a water filter. Question for you too. I mean, there was I see a lot of my patients, I think rightfully so, very concerned about your water in plastic bottles, which is obviously very convenient. I personally like to at home have I like the taste better also too out of glass bottles. But is that worrisome, the particles, or do they get rid of those PCBs in the plastic, or is it still there?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So there are a lot, there are a few. The most concerning thing I have is people who are getting their water from a well. Up to 1 in 8 Americans get their water from a well, and the well is just on your own property.
Right.
And unlike your municipal or city water, that well is not regulated by the Safe Drinking Water Act. So it is infrequently tested. It also tends to be in rural areas that are nearby farms, farms that might spray pesticides. The pesticides wash off from the nearby farms and they contaminate the groundwater, say 15 to 50 feet below the surface. If you have a shallow well, you can be drinking pesticide contaminated laced water for years, especially as a kid, putting yourself at higher risk for getting these neurological disorders in the future. So if you have a well, or almost everyone, I recommend a water filter. So a simple water filter from the grocery store, you can put on your faucet, you can use a pitcher to reduce your exposure. If you have a well, you should test your well, not just for bacteria, which are routinely tested for when you often buy or sell your home, but for pesticides and industrial chemicals. Now, that said, I still get concerned about chemicals, even being in municipal water. So I mentioned a water filter. And then microplastics, which you were alluding to with plastic bottles. A recent study suggested that microplastics might damage the dopamine-producing nerve cells that are harmed in Parkinson's disease. That study was in the last year. It's still early, but just another reason to use a water filter or a reverse osmosis system and to avoid drinking water from plastic bottles.
You know, another thing that, and I've interviewed a couple of interesting experts, actually I had a neuropathologist on a couple of weeks ago from Mount Sinai, terrific guy. You know, we were talking about head trauma. And obviously with, you know, head trauma is not just like with things that you think about, like with boxing. I mean, all kinds of obviously football and probably even soccer and other things too. How concerning is the head trauma to developing Parkinson's?
I think it's concerning. A single concussion with loss of consciousness is associated with about a 50% increased risk of Parkinson's. I get really concerned about repeated head injuries. As you might know, there have been studies looking at soccer players in Italy, Scotland, and Spain, and they found an increased risk of ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease in these individuals. And I think, well, what do soccer players do? Well, one, they get repeated head trauma. And
Well, they
two,
also
they
do that. They
play.
head the ball, which, you know, I
Yeah.
played soccer in junior high school, and I remember I used to hate to do that. It hurt, you know, to
Yeah,
catch.
yeah. And if you're a professional, you're heading the ball that's coming down from 50 feet in the air.
Right.
And then what else do soccer players do? Well, they play on sports fields, and what are those sports fields sprayed with? They're sprayed with pesticides. What are pesticides? Many of them are neurotoxins. And so I worry that soccer players are both getting head trauma and either inhaling or absorbing, again, fat-soluble pesticides through their skin and potentially damaging the
And it's like a
motor
double
nerves.
whammy. You know, I don't know what the answer is to. You know, like, again, also, I started to hear, I know a lot of you in high school fields, they have like these like synthetic fields that are like these small fiber things, which also, I believe, are kind of relatively
Yeah.
toxic.
And in writing this book, I found out that schools are routinely sprayed with pesticides. Schools and playgrounds are routinely sprayed with pesticides, many of which are nerve toxins. And we ask why one in 31 8-year-olds in the United States get autism. I just think we're just not awake. We're a little bit asleep, and that slumber needs to end.
To all my listeners of this podcast, you probably know I have a lot of experience in diagnosing and treating mold-related illness. What you might not know is that not all mold testing laboratories are the same. In the past decade of diagnosing mold-related illness, I have used exclusively real-time labs urine mycotoxin testing. It's a spot urine sample that accurately confirms my patient's symptoms as they relate to the mold exposure in their home. Now, there are other labs that do urine mycotoxin testing, but I have found from my own experience that they are not as accurate and reliable as the real-time tests. So, if you suspect you have a mold-related illness and go for testing with your doctor, ask them specifically that you want the real-time urine mycotoxin test. And you can say that you heard from Dr. Mitchell, it's the one that he trusts the most.
Yeah. All right. So, Ray, I want to get to before we kind of finish up. I think about treatment. It's obviously, and you mentioned this in the book. It's kind of interesting. I mean, it's really since, I don't know, the 60s or 70s since they discovered L-DOPA as the medication that helps relieve some of the Parkinson's symptoms. It doesn't stop the progression, unfortunately, but sometimes it can help a little bit with the movement. Why do you think the lack of advancement, or are there things? I think you mentioned in your new book, The Parkinson's Plan. I mean, I don't know. I heard also too. I remember, you know, we all know Muhammad Ali, which was very shocking. You know, when he developed Parkinson's disease, you know, to see this elite athlete, you know, walking with the Parkinson's gait and having the tremor and everything. And I think I remember him getting deep brain stimulation. I could be wrong, but it sounded like he was trying, and maybe it sounded experimental years ago. But what is the place for that? And I mean, and is there anything really exciting on the horizon that, you know, once unfortunately people have this, that they can get relief?
So deep brain stimulation works by inserting wire electrodes down into the brain. The substantia nigra is part of a circuit, and parts of that circuit get inappropriately underactive, and some get inappropriately overactive. And these electrodes dampen the output from different clusters of nerve cells in the brain. And for the right individuals, those under 75 with Parkinson's disease who've responded to medications and have developed complications of it, it can be quite beneficial. Michael Hogan, the author on the book with me, is one of the world's experts in the surgical treatment of the book of Parkinson's disease, and he devotes chapters 8 and 9 to discussing some of these surgical treatments. I think more fundamentally, why aren't we making the progress that we would like to make in Parkinson's disease? Why isn't there a cure? People have been talking about a cure for 20 years. Why isn't it arrived? The prerequisite to curing a disease in medicine is to know its cause. The prerequisite to curing a disease in medicine is to first know its cause. And, you know, you and I trained, you know, we saw bleeding ulcers, right? When we were in training, bleeding ulcers came in all the time into the emergency room. You had to type and cross the blood. You had to get the blood transfusions. It was a bloody mess. And then scientists figured out that bleeding ulcers wasn't due to stress, but it was due to H. pylori. We give people an antibiotic. And when's the last time you heard about someone dying from a bleeding ulcer?
Right.
That, I mean, in the 1960s, the top 10 leading cause of death. Now it's almost unheard of. When we were in school, there was something called non-hep A, non-hep B, right? People were getting liver disease and no one could figure out what it was. It turned out it was a new virus, hepatitis C. I think to the shock and astonishment of both of us, you know, when we were in medical school, liver transplants was the treatment for hepatitis C, which was causing then a bloody mess. You got to go harvest livers from people who were dying, bring it in, transplant it, hope that the surgeon didn't get nicked.
Right.
Whole thing.
But I want to ask you something. But it seems like we do know what the, well, I don't know if we say the cause. Well, I think you've alluded in your book the causes. But it seems like we also know the problem, that it's this lack of dopamine.
And well, no, we know the consequence. We know the consequence of it, but we don't know what the proximate cause is. And if we, I think we do. I think it's these chemicals.
Right, but let's say it's those chemicals. But let's say, I mean, L-DOPA just sort of is the Band-Aid to replenish. I mean,
yeah, it's the Band-Aid.
Stem cells or some kind of CRISPR or something.
Or screen compounds against these toxicants in the lab. Just like you screen for chemicals against hepatitis C or HIV. Once you know what the proximate cause, the root cause of disease is, you're talking about functional medicine, every disease have causes. If you figure out what the root cause is, then you can screen compounds in the lab that look at trichloroethylene, that look at chlorpyrifos, that look at paraquat and see what can slow down these actions. If you don't know
I'm saying, like with hepatitis C, just for example, we have treatments for that now.
I mean, yeah, we cure it now.
Right, they're very effective, right, in bringing the load. I mean, look, again, it's a virus, you know, versus antibacterias. Yeah. But this is a neurological degeneration.
And all we're focused on is treating the sequelae of the nerve degeneration. We are treating it after the dopaminergic nerve cells have died off, just like we're treating hepatitis C after the cancer is already developed. It's a bloody mess. It's expensive. It's got side effects. It's not terribly effective.
It's also a losing game, unfortunately, a lot of times.
It's a losing game. We're chasing our tails. Let's go upstream. Let's figure out what's causing the disease in the first place. Let's take action to prevent it. We stopped smoking. We got rid of lung cancer. We figured out what caused AIDS. It was HIV. We got a condom. We got rid of HIV might disappear as a major clinical entity in our lifetime. Unfathomable.
Oh, I know. I tell my listeners all the time, when I walked onto the wards in the mid-1980s, I had 28 patients. They were dying every week. It was frightening.
Do you know how many people we've cured of HIV?
Millions, I'm sure.
No, cure.
Oh, cured.
Five.
Oh.
Five, you know, because they don't have a protein.
65 receptor thing, whatever.
Exactly. So we've cured five people, but we've prevented millions, tens of millions. Maybe you, maybe me, maybe certainly your listeners don't have HIV because we figured out what the cause was and we took action to prevent people from getting the disease.
Good
point.
We
just need to change it. If we move upstream and we stop exposing the kids to pesticides, if we stop exposing soccer athletes to pesticides on the sports fields, if we stop exposing people to dry cleaning chemicals that are known to cause cancer, we create a world where 1 in 31 children don't have autism, which they didn't have when we were young. We create a world where soccer players aren't getting ALS, which is not a natural consequence. We create a world where Parkinson's is not the world's fastest growing disease, but the world's fastest declining disease. We just need to change our orientation and move upstream, in the words of functional medicine, identify the causes of the disease and take action.
One last area, too, I just want to ask you about is the genetics. Now, you mentioned this in your book, too, because I guess he's been open about it. It's pretty interesting. Sergey Brin, you know, the Google co-founder. You know, it's interesting. I guess, you know, his wife or his ex-wife was one of the founders of 23andMe, and he found out he had what's called the LRRK2 gene, which makes people a little bit more susceptible to, I guess, the alpha-synuclein not folding properly and stuff. When does that become something that people should know about? I mean, does it become, because, you know, one of the things I don't like about genetic testing is it becomes like the Damocles sword, you know? I mean, we really don't know. Like you said, it could be exposures. How do you know you're going to get it? Then you're walking around your whole life, you know, worried and depressed.
I'd like to take a moment to let my listeners know that my new book, Conquering Candida, is now available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. If you believe you suffer from Candida, this is the first book in 50 years since the original book, The Yeast Connection by Dr. William Crook, to give credence to this underdiagnosed and undertreated condition. If you also want to understand gut health and the microbiome, I also believe you will enjoy this book. I do appreciate if you read this book to rate it on Amazon and provide your comments and a review.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about the environmental causes of Parkinson's. Let's take a moment to talk about the genetic causes. So there's a great study called PD Generation. It's free. It's available to anyone in the United States. It's led by the Parkinson's Foundation. Kudos to them. It offers free genetic counseling, which is, I think, is important, and genetic testing to anyone with Parkinson's in the United States and other parts of the world. And they looked at the results for the first 8,000 individuals. 8,000 individuals, they looked at the results of genetic testing from them. Of that 8,000, 13% carry a genetic cause or genetic risk factor for the disease. The most common cause, genetic cause, is mutations in this gene called LRRK2, which Sergey Brin runs in his family. He's publicly disclosed that. And the most common genetic risk factor is a mutation in a gene called GBA, which when people are exposed to pesticides might heighten your risk of Parkinson's disease. So some of these 13% might explain why some people who are exposed to these chemicals are more likely to develop the disease and why some are less likely. Said another way, 87% of Americans with Parkinson's disease do not carry any known genetic cause or genetic risk factor for the disease. But for these 13%, they're important. It turns out these 13%, what do almost all these genetic causes have in common? They damage the mitochondria that we know that these chemicals do. And LRRK2, for example, increases the activity of a protein called LRRK2 kinase. It turns out that this dry cleaning chemical, trichloroethylene, also increases the activity of this protein called LRRK2 kinase. So we know from the research and outstanding research, Dr. Andy Singleton, Christine Klein, great colleagues, that the environmental causes of Parkinson's disease in many ways are mimicking what the genetic forms of the disease are doing. And there are almost certainly gene environment interactions that explain why some people exposed to these chemicals get the disease and why some don't.
One last thing I actually want to just mention, and it has to do with the celebrities, actually. Michael J. Fox, having Parkinson's, has done amazing things above and beyond people could imagine. I feel terrible that he's had to suffer with this disease, and he's been the most incredible spokesman for it. Yes. Do we know why he got it? Has he ever disclosed that they think the risk factor for him?
So in an interview with Jane Pauley that we quote in the book, he said he thinks he got it from exposure to some kind of chemical. It turned out when he was on Family Ties, this is public report by the New York Times, he was part of a cluster of individuals from that TV show who got Parkinson's disease.
I just wanted our listeners to know that we are sometimes so blessed to have somebody like him who didn't hide his disease, is battling his disease. He's got so much to live for. And I'm so grateful for the work that he does.
So Michael J. Fox says that Parkinson's disease sucks, and it sucks. So it's hard to have the disease, but it's hard to have the disease and be the face of it. And for 30 years, he's been the face of Parkinson's disease. At a minimum, he's reduced the stigma and the social burden of having that disease for millions of people around the world. We need to recognize that the heroism of people like Muhammad Ali, like Michael J. Fox, like Brian Grant, like Davis Finney, Ali Signorelli, Larry Gifford, people who put themselves out there to reduce the burden of the disease for others. The course of HIV was changed, not by infectious disease experts, no offense. It was changed by people who were directly affected by the disease. People most directly affected by disease, March of Dimes, when they make their voices heard, they change the course of disease. They do it not just for themselves. They do it for all of us, and they do it for generations to come. These are the heroes in the community. These are the people who will change the course of disease so that you and I will be talking about Parkinson's disease being in the textbooks, HIV being in the textbooks, polio being in the textbooks, drinking and driving being completely socially unacceptable. We should applaud, we should recognize, we should support these individuals because they're the ones changing it, not just for themselves, they're changing it for all of us.
Absolutely. Very well said. Dr. Ray Dorsey, your books are amazing. The Parkinson's Plan, that's the new one. I really loved it. I really loved Ending Parkinson's too. You can't go wrong getting both of them. If you have a family member, is there anything else that you would like to mention, Dr. Ray, before we finish?
No, thank you, Doug, very much, Dr. Mitchell. The books are available on Amazon or wherever you like to get your books. If any of your listeners have questions with us, questions for us, they can just email us at info@pdplan.org. info@pdplan.org. We're happy to answer your questions. I read everything that comes in. And thank you very much for helping us get the voice, the message out. You know, in your specialty, you know, we've changed the courses of lots of diseases. It's time for neurology to catch up to allergy and immunology and change the course of diseases that people fear the most: Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, autism, ALS, and others.
Yeah, well, we're lucky to have you and Dr. Oak and, you know, first-class people and doctors and researchers, you know, leading the way. So thanks again.
Thanks for joining me here on UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell. If today's conversation was useful to you, please share it with someone who could benefit. You can find every episode of The Smartest Doctor in the Room wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, stay well.